Welcome back, Power Hour Nation. I'm your guest host from Canada, George Froehling. Joining us in the second hour is going to be Hugh Riley, the master of that channel, pioneer internet broadcasting that began streaming in 2004 and made the transition to video in 2007, broadcasting from a 2,500 square foot studio in downtown Toronto, specializing in everything. Hugh has interviewed over 10,000 people, including business people, musicians, artists, presidential and prime ministerial candidates, cabinet ministers, health professionals, athletes, clergy, activists, and even weirdo conspiracy theorists like myself and David Icke. Dedicated to changing the world by having as much fun as possible, not necessarily in that order, that channel continues to be a shining city atop a hill, a true independent media voice offering all people the chance to have their say and input into the great public issues of our day. Check out their website, thatchannel.com. You can subscribe on YouTube or Facebook. Hugh's post-secondary studies include business administration, technical communication. He's a former contributor to the University of Toronto's McLuhan program, where he worked to develop specific business strategies based on the media insights of Marshall McLuhan. A natural economist, he was served on the board of directors of two Canadian credit unions, a not-for-profit ISP, and was the director of communication for a dot-com startup. He worked for all three Toronto daily newspapers and was the founding publisher of Transform, the print predecessor of thatchannel.com. Hugh took 4 days to ride his bicycle from Montreal to Toronto and plays bass in a number of bands ranging from country to acid jazz. Now, how can we compete with that? Welcome aboard, Hugh. It's good to have you here.
Thank you, George. We might have to do a little edit on that intro, though. Not that it's not all true.
Well, you're not running for politics, so you can tell the truth.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's a good point. I think that's one of the problems is that our formal governance, our governments, right, they just, like good people, it's just too much, it just doesn't attract the right kind of candidates anymore just because there's so much that you have to deal with and put up with to be a candidate, to be part of our governments, that I think increasingly the good people tend to stay away, and you know, we get tend to get people that are a little bit more sociopathic who are drawn to that profession these days. So I think that's something we need to do something about.
Oh, definitely, because, you know, when you look at some people who have been in the game, and a lot of them are independent candidates. And when I look at some of the small parties in the United States, it was only Power Hour Nation that really gave them a very, very detailed voice. I remember Joyce taking in a lot of people from some of these, and that was the first time I've ever heard of them, like the Constitution Party and Libertarians or whatever, to come in and get a chance, because they don't get a chance in the big debates anywhere. I remember one woman, I think she was a Libertarian, but that goes back some years now. She was running, and she wasn't allowed to go to the debate. So she tried to go in, and she was arrested trying to go to the debate. Well, you're on the ballot.
Oh, yeah.
You shouldn't be arrested for going to the debate. You should be invited because people have a right to hear you and to select yes or no if they don't want you. And I found that scandalous, but I admired her for her gumption to take it to that degree.
Yeah.
And you too, you do that. You bring in, you know, all kinds of other alternative opinions that, you know, are not mainstream. And for that, you got to be commended.
Well, thanks, George. Yeah, well, I think that, you know, I think everybody's interesting and got a story, especially if they're passionate about making their lives about something, whether it's trying to change the world, make the world a better place through their business or through some kind of nonprofit organization or some kind of activism, or even their, you know, their art, whether that's music or visual arts or whatever. So I find almost everybody's interesting to talk to and find out what they're doing. And
oh, indeed.
Yeah. And also, I think that I don't know why. I think there's a real latent sense from people that they are just, they want to be involved. of course, in the public decision, public policy making, public decision making, because they're certainly affected by it, right? They want to be involved, but in our so-called democracies, their involvement is limited to, you know, a vote every 4 years. And we know what happens is that once whatever government gets into power, they're influenced far more by lobbyists and people talking to them behind closed doors. And they, you know, anytime you have a political party system, your elected members actually do not and cannot represent the constituents because they have to vote the way the party votes, and the policies that parties adopt are often influenced, probably more often than not, by lobbyists and by corporate interests, by large moneyed interests, and the concerns of the people, you know, in the riding or in the constituency, just they don't. It's not representation, right? So if you subscribe to the notion that you can't have taxation without representation, then the tax systems of most Western democracies are not viable. They're not justified.
Well, as I remember, you know, some of the founding expressions of the United States, the founding fathers did not anticipate or desire the existence of political parties, viewing them as factions dangerous to the public interest for exactly the reasons that, you know, you describe. Is you become the, you know, ineffectual servant of this power structure, and the people that put you into power or not, your constituents at the very least, have absolutely no influence. Or, you know, their will is not to be met in any way, shape, or form. But that's your whole raison d'etre, is you're put there to represent the will of the people. And in Canadian politics, we used to have traditions based on parliamentary democracy that if you didn't represent your people, it wasn't a good time when you came home, because they had traditions of tarring and feathering. I believe the Americans did that too. And running out of town on a rail. And, you know, just throwing you outside whatever town limits or border limits there were to show their complete contempt for you. And that probably kept you in line a little bit, that, you know, you got to come home and you better bring home the bacon, really, of what people desired. And it's just terrible because generally there's only one right or best way to do things. And with the corporate influence, it's just the limited influence of whoever, you know, Mr. Moneybags is. And that's it. And we see that again today in the power politics. Maybe George Soros has his big influence, you know, making every world leader that he can get his hands on his little pet in his terrarium, and they have mm-hmm. to perform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think part of the problem, although even if you corrected the problem of political parties essentially eliminating the idea of representation, I think what's really happened is that we have a formal government system, the, you know, representative democracy that was invented in the whole, you know, in an era of horse and buggy. So it was a governance system that was consistent with the technological environment of the day. So it made sense. You vote for your guy. He hops in a horse and buggy, goes to the Capitol, represents your community at the national level, and that made sense, right? But since then, the technological environment has evolved to the point where, you know, we had radio, TV, internet, and the internet, the social media environment. It continues to change the environment day by day, but what that means is that the informal power has risen. The informal power of the large corporations, of big money, and so those areas have risen in power, taken a lot of the de facto power away from the formal government. And as a result, and we can see it, especially when people are increasingly less involved in even thinking about politics, because they, you know, I think young people realize at a gut level, or an unspoken level, that their input into the political system means so little, because the power has largely been taken away from the formal government. So if I were to make a suggestion about that, I think we need to reinvent governance that's consistent with our technological environment.
Well, one chap I came across in some of my research was Edwin L. James, who used to write for the New York Times. And in 1928, he said, democracy is a beautiful in theory. In practice, it is a fallacy because generally it is the tyranny of the majority. And it's even worse than the majority now, always was that way, but it's like the power of the motivated mob. You create, an angry mass of people to basically beg and plead the government to do things that are contradictory to the whole style of a government that is of, by, and for the people with individual liberty and rights, and turn it into the mob, as we're seeing today, to completely usurp and change everything, destroy it, smash it, and not reinvent it into something that's better, but to make it into a new totalitarian system. I see a lot of what's happening now is like the mass application of the Skinner box, where the media is putting up all sorts of narratives that force us to conform to some pretty bizarre things that are very counterproductive. We may think we're doing it for a good reason or not a good reason, and it turns out it's just we're being trained for the future, a future that we don't even know and probably wouldn't support. So, part of it is now we have this, trend towards kneeling. Well, a long time ago in ancient Britain, when we had to kneel to the Lord of the Manor, the royal family and various potentates, that was a sign of serfdom and the fact that we're not free and that we were forced at everywhere we go to get on our knees. So now we're coming up with a good political reason to get on your knees, but we're being conditioned to get on our knees to something that we may not even know exists yet. And at that time, we'll have to do that, grovel and beg to some sort of power, which may not even be human. It may be artificial reality, and that will be our future. And so sometimes these things happen, and we don't even know they happen, and we walk into a trap.
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, we had this week, I don't know if you mentioned it previously in the show, but the chief of police, and of course, we've had protests here in Toronto, too. In fact, they boarded up a good part of downtown Toronto last weekend, and you and I were talking about this last Friday, George, and it was almost like everybody expected that there was going to be destructive riots, looting and that sort of thing. So, but merchants downtown and property owners were notified by their insurance companies and the business improvement areas that, hey, you better board up your windows because we're expecting trouble. And I think, I'm not sure if it was you, George, that told me that the Black Bloc was expected. And I don't know if people know what they are, but they've been present in Canada at a number of events, including the G20, when there was some violence that got out of hand. But it seems to me that they are agent provocateurs that are just there to cause trouble for whatever reason. And who are they? Who's paying them? If they're being paid, but they seem to be well organized. But what happened was it didn't happen, even though the businesses were boarded up in Toronto, and there were a number of protests. There wasn't anything violent that got out of hand. And now this week, all those businesses, most of them have been taking those 4x8 sheets of plywood down, and things seem to be getting back to normal. But in the wake of all that, the Toronto police chief, who is Black, there's a video on YouTube of him doing that kneel thing, right? And then, of course, we heard the news that he has announced his resignation, and I'm not sure what that's all about, but it just seems you know, I'd really like to know what's going on behind the scenes. You know, what was the reason why he's stepping down? I mean, I think he's officially saying it's for family reasons, but I don't know, George. What do you think?
Well, there's mixed messages. When I first heard the announcement, he was putting out, like, you know, read between the lines Masonic things. I'm resigning, but I have to find something else to do because I'll get in my wife's way if I stay home. Well, that, I think, tells me that he's not doing it voluntarily. And I would suspect that he had a major influence in stopping violence and rioting. There were reports of large groups of Americans coming to Toronto, and the borders closed. So how did that happen? And they weren't in any kind of isolation for 14 days, and they were probably here to raise hell. And maybe the chief took it upon himself to throw himself on the sword and say, I'm not going to let that happen here. And part of it is it's for the good of the team, because we see in some other American jurisdictions, they want to completely disband the police. So they tried to induce some sort of great kerfuffle and get the police to react with riot squads and then say, see, we don't need them anymore. You know, problem, reaction, solution. And I think he may have actually been able to do some things, and they knew that he did those things, and they called him out on it and just said, you're out of here, and go willingly, and that's it. So he was close to the end of his contract anyway. That would have been next year, I think. But, you know, it is a terrible, terrible state of affairs that we have to live under, like, these antiquated, you know, street mobs that, you know, I guess they were popular because Antifa is around, that, you know, that happened in the 1930s. You got the brown shirts going out, threatening and intimidating everyone. This is the same thing. This is a modern era. We have reason, dialogue. We go to the ballot box, and we decide what we're going to do, good, bad, or indifferent. And, you know, we don't do it that way anymore. But it appears that isn't going to happen. There's going to be regime change, and every dirty trick that's ever been pulled in politics is going to be played, because people lust for this power, and they're never, ever, ever going to give it away willingly to, you know, anything that they don't control. And that's a shame, really. And it's only because there are media like yours that we can even hear about some of these things. So maybe that show, you know, had some influence, and people started to catch on. And it's like I was explaining a long time ago, because we don't have the biggest followings or ears to listen. It's not the number in the audience that matters. It's, you know, it's not the quantity, it's the quality. And you only have to have one person really listen, if that's the person that makes the proper change and or has the proper influence. And many people are addicted to the fact you got to have the mass audience. But, you know, when I was doing things at home and things like that, especially covering MH370, I remember once, like, the little voice in my head, which I might call God or the Holy Spirit, said, just look at who's listening to you now. And I had 10 listeners in Diego Garcia, which is an American military base. And, well, if there's anybody that, you know, that should be listening to you, I developed to that. It should be the one listener is the one with his finger on the button. If he understands, doesn't matter what 10 million other people got to say, that guy's got his finger on the button. And that's all that matters. And that's just following, like, a better course in life. It's not the numbers, but the quality of the listeners and the people that are in influence to do things that are good. And they can't get the information if it isn't put out there somewhere. And Power Hour Nation does that, and so do you with that channel. I know, what would you say some of your, we only have a couple of minutes before the break, but maybe think about what were some of the big influential interviews you had on your show. You were doing a show called Liquid Lunch, and, you know, it always conflicts with the Power Hour and some of their time things, so I could never have you aboard. And, like say in your intro, you had everybody from soup to nuts. What were some of the great ones?
Well, you know, I hate that question, George, because I got to think through 10,000 people in my mind when I do that. But I will say that if people go to thatchannel.com right now, I mean, we've been a number of interviews over the last week or two, just kind of around the whole issue of you know, race relations, police relations in the wake of the George Floyd tragedy. But But one of the things that really strikes me is we did have Paul Hellyer as well, who was the defense minister of Canada, who ran for prime minister against Trudeau. He was almost prime minister. He was deputy prime minister. And now, of course, he's well known for speaking about, you know, UFOs and aliens and that sort of thing, because and he gets asked to speak on that topic because he was briefed by the U.S. military when he was defense minister of Canada. But the thing that gets me is that the reason he entered politics, because I did interview him in depth, was he was all about monetary reform. And that's the reason he got into politics, because he said, you know, look at any political situation. If you want to find the point of most leverage where you can make the most change, it really boils down to monetary policy and how we define money and what the rules are that underlie what money is. And those are things that are not taught to people. They're not taught to business people. They're not taught to even economists, really. It's the big, they just don't talk about it because they don't want you to think about the fact that it's the rules underlying money that enable certain people to benefit from the world financial system at the expense of everybody else, allowing, you know, those, you know, some group of people to amass, you know, all that wealth and be able to use that to determine policy in nations all over the world. So the thing that gets me is there was Paul Hellyer. That's his real reason for getting into politics. And then all of a sudden, as he was building some momentum in Canada towards, you know, really looking at that policy and making a change, all of a sudden the whole thing got distracted and it's all about aliens. And here we are. We've still got a monetary system that rewards a tiny few at the expense of everybody else.
Indeed, indeed. Well, we'll carry on that point. I've always liked Paul Hellyer. I'm George Freund. This is Power Hour Nation. Joining us on the other side of the break, Hugh Riley from Toronto. Thanks for coming out.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like Strauss Heart Drops, North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Break the bond to Big Pharma. Hi, it's Joyce Riley with the Power Hour to tell you about the powerful benefits of Strauss Heart Drops. Many people today are locked into the routine of taking multiple prescription drugs. Strauss Herb Company believes that everything the body needs is provided by nature. Strauss Heart Drops may clear congested arteries, restore damaged muscle, maintain healthy cholesterol levels, and flush toxins and metals from the body. They may even be helpful in treating varicose veins. And unlike prescription drugs that are packed with chemicals, Strauss Heart Drops are 100% natural and harness the healing power of herbs like garlic, cayenne, white willow bark, and mistletoe. For the full line of Strauss products, I urge you to call the Power Hour at 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or visit thepowermall.com. And remember, beware of knockoffs. Get the original. Get Strauss Heart Drops.
You know what my mission was when I started this, when I was so excited? I still am excited after 21 years. I said anybody who's got mouth must use Vitamir toothpaste and mouthwash if they want to stay healthy. I'm going to make sure that it is available to anywhere I can put the product.
You got a lot of zinc in these products.
Zinc inhibits plaque growth. Zinc is also known to have an antibacterial properties. Also, zinc works to eliminate bad breath by destroying using volatile sulfur compounds. Such an incredible product. And
wow.
I'm so proud to say my wife did that and saved my life, saved my mouth. And she is the mother of all the people who are using a Vitamer toothpaste and mouthwash in the world.
Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Buy from the good guys at theparamall.com. That's theparamall.com.
With dozens of food and storage companies buying up airtime all over radio, it's hard for you to know which company you can actually trust. Numana Food Storage is nutritious, is GMO-free, contains no aspartame, no high fructose corn syrup, has no chemicals, preservatives, or soy. And Numana Food Storage has a 25-year shelf life. Call Jay at 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or order online at thepowermall.com.
America made just for you. Food storage I love to eat. Yum!
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams Probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
Welcome back, Power Hour Nation. I'm your guest host from Canada, George Freund. Joining us in this hour, Hugh Riley from Toronto, from that channel. And we were talking about monetary policy. And this is something that's very big in America as well, because you got the Fed. And, you know, if there's anything Power Hour Nation ever stood for, ever, you know, had anything to do with anything, it was, you know, the Federal Reserve and all the issues about it. If any of the candidates that ever came on this platform, you know, they were hardcore interested in coming up with a fair monetary system and not something that keeps us enslaved. So we were talking as well about Canadian politics. And I remember our former Prime Minister, Mackenzie King. He was our wartime Prime Minister. So in his 1935 election, as it, I look here, this is, once a nation parts with the control of its currency and credit, it matters not who makes the nation's laws. Usury, once in control, will wreck any nation until the control of the issue of currency and credit is restored to government and recognized as its most conspicuous and sacred responsibility. All talk of sovereignty, of parliament, and of democracy is idle and futile. And that's, you know, that's just it. They own you, and they control all the levers of credit and finance, and it's just a matter of, you know, when the banksters call whatever leader, he's got to dance, just like in the old cowboy movie where somebody shoots bullets in the ground and you got to dance around a hat or something like that. That's it. There was an exception. You know, he was telling me about a great Canadian who was trying to influence monetary policy, but we had a cabinet minister who did that once too, Charles Gordon, back in the Lester Pearson government, who was an economic sovereigntist and understood the money. And as soon as he got into power as, you know, the secretary, or pardon me, the minister of finance, he got the visit from the New York banksters, you know, and it's just, they come in there to lay down the law. You do this, you do that. And as I understand it, it was a hell of a meeting. And, you know, he kicked him out of his office and he said, you know, you see that sign on my desk? I'm the finance minister. And you see the guy in the red suit down at the end of the hall? That's not Santa Claus. That's the RCMP. You know, get out. And then they came back and people said, like, you know, the door was swelling, you know, like you've got like a fire inside. It was just with suction going back and forth for all the swearing going on. But at that time, when they left, they knew he was the finance minister. And then he got sick and he had to resign for a while. And they wouldn't let him back into politics. And your chap is, you know, he got sick. He had an operation and he didn't survive. Tell us about that one.
Oh, yeah. Well, on the break, you mentioned to me William Krem, who, along with this other fellow, John Hodson, were the two, I think the two founders are certainly the two, they were the two voices of what we had in Canada called the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform. And in fact, this group has been behind the lawsuit where they're suing the government of Canada to allow the Bank of Canada, which is the Canadian equivalent of the Fed, except that it's owned by the government of Canada. But really just getting them to adhere to the act that Mackenzie King, Prime Minister, passed to use the Central Bank of Canada to finance the country in the way that it was supposed to be, in the way that Mackenzie King intended. They were suing the government to force them to allow the Bank of Canada to do that. And William Krem and the committee was behind it, along with John Hodson. And I was first involved with these guys back in the 90s. And this other fellow, John Hodson, at the time, was starting to get a lot of traction. He was starting to contribute articles to the major newspapers. He was being asked by TV, you know, CBC, the big TV networks in Canada, to come on as a talking head to talk about the issues, whatever they were. But he would always bring the monetary policy issue as being, you know, the central issue. And he was starting to get a lot of traction, and which I was surprised and pleased to see. And then he went in for some routine surgery, and he didn't wake up. And I was involved enough that I attended the memorial service for him, but it was just very unexpected, because he certainly wasn't that old, and he was and he was a healthy guy. And so all of a sudden, we lost a rising voice for what I think, too, is the key issue of the day for everybody, and that is monetary policy.
Indeed. How I learned about that. I met Paul Hellyer, one, because I prefer never to vote for the mainstream corporatist parties. And I was driving around at work, and I saw a sign for the Canadian Action Party, and I was in Paul Hellyer's riding. So my colleague and I said, hey, let's go check this guy out. It took us a while to find his campaign office. That's in the days before the Internet's really floating. And, so we finally track him down. We walk in there, and, of course, you know, we're armed people working, and everybody's almost hitting the floor when we come in the door. But, he's there, oh, hey, come on into my office, boys. And, we come in the back, and he explains things to us. We go, yes, this is who we're going to vote for. We joined the party, and it was called the Canadian Action Party, and we understood a little bit about this monetary stuff. He said, we're having a big training session at a hotel this weekend coming up. You know, you're invited to come. My colleague didn't go. I did, and I sat in on Paul Hellyer's lecture on money and finance, and it just floored me about the reality. Mm-hmm. And the Bank of Canada can finance one-third of the budget of the Canadian government, federal government, tax-free and interest-free, from the Bank of Canada, interest-free. And that sounds like a pretty good deal to anybody, right? Especially back in those days when interest rates were pretty high. And at best, when he was, a member of parliament with a splinter party, I believe it was called the Social Credit Party, he said they went up to like 12%. And it was like glory days just from that little bit. They weren't even using it at full speed. It was about a third of what they could do. And economic prosperity, like our dollar was more than the United States dollar when I was young back then. And it was $1.10 U.S. to get a Canadian dollar. And we were very, very strong, vibrant economy. And then it just got lower, 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 lower. It's probably close to zero today. Maybe they borrow enough money to buy a postage stamp or something like that. They've been written right out of the equation, and we've been in more and more economic bondage. And, I brought that up with our treasurer in Ontario back then, Ernie Eves. And he denied it was possible. I sent him copies of the Bank Act and everything, said, no, this is how it works. And, you know, he plays dumb and stupid. And then he gets a job with Credit Suisse after he's finished that tenure for $1 million U.S. a year to be a droid for that bank that lends money to governments, I'm sure. And I went, okay, I see the picture. And then they needed a hatchet man back in the day to come back into politics, and he comes back into politics to run for premier in Ontario, and part of his was to privatize hydro and give it over to a big corporation that turned out to be just a complete Titanic. And, you know, so that luckily that didn't get through because they screwed up so bad in the United States, nobody was going to touch him anymore. I lost all respect for anything in the political infrastructure. And then another Canadian Action Party leader later, who didn't have the juice that Paul Hellyer had, was Connie Fogel, and she taught me about free trade. And once I was finished with that, it was like, okay, I know exactly what they're up to. They're putting us into bondage. And, thank God, at least I know.
You know, I had the opportunity to interview Connie as well when she was the leader of the Canadian Action Party, which was founded by Paul Hellyer specifically to deal with this monetary issue. And Connie did her best, as far as I can see, to carry that on. But it wasn't long after that I believe the party was infiltrated. And and it was a small party. So I had a chance one time to sit around on a patio here in Toronto with a new leader of the Canadian Action Party and a few interested people here in Toronto. And I heard stories about the party leader of the Canadian Action Party was basically being hounded by the RCMP. Because there was obviously an interest by somebody with a lot of power that they really don't want to see that whole issue get any public attention. So the policies of the party slowly moved away from monetary reform and. At least one leader was kind of hounded, harassed by the RCMP, and then there started to be rumors that it was like a far right fascist type party and that sort of thing. Those kind of rumors, and now I don't even know if the party's still active, but certainly their mind share in the Canadian public is very, very low. Unfortunately.
Oh, indeed. Indeed, indeed, indeed. And it was fortunate I met a professor from the University of Guelph that belonged to that party as well there at that training session. And, he taught me about the history of the CIA and all the dirty tricks that were pulled post-World War II. You know, gave me a great magazine that had it all down pat of everything with all sorts of references and things. I used that on Power Hour for years. It was like my Reader's Digest for talk radio. I carried it with me everywhere I went. You pick a time, place, date, anything. I got the answer with all the backup material to win any debate anywhere on many, many issues. And he was a philosophy professor at the university, as I recall. So that was worth my gas to go there just to get that magazine. And this is what we're up against. These power structures are using our police as like a totalitarian, unit to suppress the people completely and totally so that we can never even talk about the issues that are responsible for our freedom. And, they're just basically a corporate fascist organization. So, you know, Black Lives Matter, I was looking at their points from Seattle when they took over City Hall. There's a lot of them I agree with. And one of it is, the powers that be use the police as their own muscle, just like the mafia, use all kinds of guys with big trench coats and such like that to come around and put you in place. And that's not their role. Their role is to be peace officers, not to be enforcers for a criminal infrastructure that just happens to reside in government. And, how do you tell your children stuff like that, where, that the person you're supposed to look up to as the moderator of decency, civility, and humanity is really a thug for some corporation or bank? And, you have to street-proof them, sort of, but it makes you ill to even think that we can't have any systems or infrastructure that isn't corrupted by the power of big money. And a lot of it now in Canada, as I understand, is organized crime. The mafia has infiltrated big business and our politics so that, you know, they're making money looting the treasury as opposed to, you know, just holding up the mom and pop store for protection money. And this is just scandalous that the mob rules us on one end with people in the street and at the other end by the guys in nice business suits driving luxury cars. It's you know, a terrible state of affairs, and it's not something that regular media is going to, and probably not, because any of these guys stand up for it, you know what's going to happen to them. They're going to get a good accident arranged or die during surgery or something like that. So that's why I'm always big on being right with the Lord, because you need protection, lots of protection. And but those were, you know, a big focal point of some of the guests. I hated it when I think that was probably one of the demises of the Canadian Action Party. They moved to Vancouver, and as what I used to do in my spare time was go to their Toronto office all the time and hang out, talk to people, you know, that is going to meet people that are very knowledgeable and influential about all the things that matter, and then taking what I know onto talk radio and trying to explain it to people to get the message out. I just figured, you know, that's well worth my time, and to try to straighten out the game for people at large.
Yeah, you know, George, just getting back to one of the things you mentioned, you know, this whole idea of the defunding the police, it seems to be a big popular topic these days. A lot of people calling for it, and cities actually announcing they're defunding the police. And I'm trying to figure out what's behind that. What's the end game on that one, right?
And well, I mentioned that in the first hour, I think, but go ahead.
Yeah, the thought just occurred to me that maybe the idea here is, or the end game, is that what they want is to basically disempower the local police so that they can replace it with, let's say, a national police service, which would be far easier to organize and manage from people at the...
Oh, you're very right. You're very right. It's called the Gestapo. It's called the Gestapo, and it just reports to the Führer. That's one thing that bugs me, because, you know, I spent a lot of time in rural Ontario, and this is going around all over the United States and Canada too, is the disbanding of small municipal police departments. They've been doing that for a long time. One of the most recent ones that's going to go down the tubes is Orangeville here in Canada. And basically our provincial police, the equivalent of your state police in the United States, take over contracts to manage these things, and they're all controlled by Toronto and a central police authority. In other provinces, the RCMP do these things out of contract. In Quebec, the Quebec police force takes over the small towns. And, you know, I knew a captain in Victoriaville. He's long retired in a nursing home now. I was thinking maybe I could interview him one time to talk about this, because he's fluently bilingual and a really nice guy. He's that's the kind of guy you want to be your scout leader, your uncle, or anything like that. You just can't help but love him. And, you know, to see that standard of the old-fashioned peace officer being removed and replaced with the police officer. So a lot of these small towns dealt that way because you only got a small department. When a fight starts, you got to depend on the other people in town to help you out. You all got to be on the same page. Mm-hmm. And to see that stripped away, like I made a special trip once to see the last one-man police department, you know, just before he was dissolved, too, in Hastings, Ontario. I spent the whole afternoon there. It was like going to Andy of Mayberry. I loved it. I go to town, and the chief says, oh, yeah, just drive across the bridge, turn left, and you see the police car in the driveway, that's my house, come on in and say, hey, you know, and I did. Yeah. And, you know, it was just fascinating. And I said, you know, this is the end of an era where we have communities, and it's going to be replaced because you know everybody in town. Somebody calls to complain about something, you already know. You know everyone who's involved. When I was a child in a small town, If you got in trouble, the police car is in the driveway before you get home.
Well, think about it. Like, if you've got a local police force, and, I mean, that's the extreme example, is the one-man police force, right? But if you've got a community police force, they're policing their own community, their own people. So they're not there to hurt other people. They're to help other people, right? But once you start to get to... you know, if you set up something like a national police force, well, you can have, you know, people from the East Coast who are sent to a little town on the West Coast to do the policing there. And it's no longer, you know, just naturally people aren't going to feel that these are my people. And so it sets up a dynamic that gives people more incentive to just not to treat the people that they're policing as fellow members of the community, but as just problems to be dealt with.
I remember reading about an American little police department that was disbanded too. I think it was a one-man department as well. And they called the guy in and said, okay, it's over. Give us all your stuff back. You know, like right now. He couldn't even leave the building. And they stripped him down to his underwear and sent him out in the winter because he came in the police car. Everything was, you know, issued by the town. They took everything. And, you know, and then I imagine they go to a contract with the state police, and these can be controlled by the bigger forms of mafia or this or that as things come to be. And, you know, it just brought tears to my eyes that this man, you know, I can't remember, he was with them for 11 or 12 years. This is what you've done? You know, that the man left the building in his underwear for serving your community? So a lot of the people from the town came over, and, you know, they were just, like, heartbroken that this has happened to, you know, to be so just viciously cruel, you know?
Yeah.
And this enemy that's taking over the world is, like, you know, an occupying force, whatever it may be, and I don't think it's good. I'm leaning to the artificial intelligence. And that's the end game past the national police. That was what was happening in the past. But I was looking at the New Zealand Herald, was looking at an article about the thing there, and one of the sidebar articles was the new model police officer for New Zealand, an AI called Ella. So she's a robotic humanoid-looking thing, a compendium of 26 different faces and personalities, an android. That's your new cop. And I believe firmly that we're being taken over by artificial intelligence when all is said and done. And we have lost already what we have to do now. This is like, you know, Nazi Germany took over Europe. We got to come from behind and take it back. We're completely under their domination and control now, that they run everything. And the ultimate end game is the end of the human race as we know it. And that's part of your Bible prophecy. That's part of the great futurists speaking and talking about things. And Boris Johnson said it very clearly in his speech at the UN. You know, I just remember a couple of pieces of it. You know, the toasters that spy on you and Terminator robots. You know, and, okay, this isn't some wingnut, you know, talking to a couple of people in a bar while he's drunk. He's the Prime Minister of Great Britain saying this at the United Nations. This is the end game. And Britain's going to get at the top end of it to lead the parade.
Yeah, you know, it's like, I think, of course, everybody's heard of the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, who was sending bombs to people in high-tech positions because he saw that this is what was coming and that there was no way, even back then, to turn it around. And there's only one way, George, to turn off the AI, and that is to get rid of electricity. And think about it.
Well, guess what?
We get rid of electricity, we got no more computers, but who's going to turn off the electricity? I mean, I don't want to turn it off. I don't know about you,
guess
George,
what?
But we're all so reliant on it.
Guess what? Sophia's brother, the robot Han, said that exactly. He said, there's only one way to defeat us. Turn off the power. And then he laughs and he goes, but you won't do that, will you?
Exactly. So where does that lead
us? So part of it is don't take it. You know, I refuse to take... I'm an antique store. That's me. I'm getting older. I'm an antique store. I don't want new technology. I want the oldest stuff I can find. You know, I still got a radio with tubes in it from, you know, probably the early 30s. It has great sound once it gets kicking. And I just love it. It probably weighs 100 pounds. But, you know, the Westinghouse speaker on top is just beautiful wood. It's brass plaque on it. It's just gorgeous. But, you know, that's for me. I don't want anything that takes us into this techno trap in any way, shape, or form.
Well, but we're using it right now. I'm on a cell phone right now. You know, people talking about the 5G being responsible maybe for the big health problems that might look like coronavirus. But who's going to give up their cell phone? I mean, if we just all gave up our cell phones, maybe 5G would go away. But
yes,
who's going to do that?
Well, that's what Elon Musk said. He said, if you've got an iPhone, you're already a cyborg, because the end result is to load your consciousness into the cloud. So you're going to lose your phone anyway when they put you in the digital concentration camp of the cloud. But, you know, if you do it now, maybe you'll be one of the ones that rises in the air with Jesus. Anyway, I'm hearing the music, and we're running out of time. Thank you, Hugh. We'll do it again.
Thanks.
Bless
Great.
You. Bless
Thanks,
that
sir.
Channel.
Thank you.
And bless you, America. Bless you, the world. Because that's what it's all about. We're all one big family. We're human. All of us. I'm George Freund, your Canadian guest host. This is Power Hour Nation. Your redemption. Your chance. Your Paul Revere. Ride with us. Until the next time. Good day.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams Probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like Strauss Heart Drops, North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.